Thank you, Trevor, for those kind introductory remarks. Toorak is in my electorate. There are 408,000 voters in my electorate, but I've never been described as a member for Toorak before, so that is novel and new. But I can probably say my electorate, which is one-eighth of the state of Victoria, probably actually pays half the stamp duty in the state of Victoria as well, to open up and be provocative. But look, thank you today to CEDA for the kind introduction and the invitation to come and speak to you about Australia's economic reform opportunities and challenges this year in 2008 and beyond. And from what you've obviously heard from your earlier speakers, there are a lot of challenges that are facing us economically as we go into this year. And so it's a very topical time to be addressing these issues. In my presentation this afternoon, there's three areas I'd like to touch on. And the first one really is Victoria's overall economic health and outlook. The second one is how we are addressing the challenges to economic prosperity, and that is through our own state ability and through national reform. And concluding really on recent improvements in prospects for what I'd call meaningful national reform through improved Commonwealth-state relations. Just starting on where we are, our own economic performance, we've got a AAA credit rating as a state, and really the drivers of that is a strong balance sheet, good financial management, but it is our diversified economy. We are a state that is increasingly diversified. It gives us some great strengths, and they're ones that show, in effect, that we have the strongest performing economy of the non-resource states in Australia. So that's one of the first things I'd like to touch on. Recent data reinforces that. We've had growth now for 2.7% in the last financial year. We have consistently, over the last 8 years, had stronger growth than the other non-resource states. And if you look at the ABS figures late last year for state final demand in the December quarter, we were 2% for the quarter and 5.2% for the year. So whatever the figures are, they're showing strong and continuous growth in the state of Victoria. And again, part of that is because of our very diversified economy. We've also got a growing population, and there's a lot of pressures that come from a growing population, as we see with congestion, with scarcity of resources, a whole range of other things. But there's an extraordinary lot of benefits that come from a growing population. For example, we've seen skilled business migrants as a subgroup of our growing population. We've grown from 17% of the national share 8 years ago to 27% of the national share today. And as we all know, skills are a critical issue for us. So part of our population growth is coming in the areas that really matter to us. And again, just in context, 60% of our population growth actually comes from immigration. I guess moving ahead to our economic performance and outlook, we have had a very strong level of business investment in Victoria during the last 8 years. And it's averaged 8.4% increase throughout that period of time. We've also seen our employment being very strong. We saw in the last year 75,500 extra people employed in Victoria, a growth rate of 2.9%. And since October 1999, when we got into government, we've seen employment increase by 455,000 people, or 21%. We've also seen unemployment at historically low rates. And in fact, the February figures of 4.1% were the lowest since the ABS began its Labor Force Australia survey in the 1970s. And unemployment has fallen 2.5% since 1999. And total value of building approvals in Victoria continues to be strong. In January, ours was $2.64 billion, better than any other state. Queensland was at 1.47, New South Wales at 1.43. And that's a consistently strong rate over the last several years. So what we're seeing is economic performance is strong. It's strong in most of the country, but it's been particularly strong in here as a non-resource state. And the graph that we see now simply highlights that. It shows, compares us to the other non-resource states than the resource states. So we're seeing consistently strong economic growth in the state. Economic growth requires investment in infrastructure, and because a more favourable general economic outlook translates into a far greater number of opportunities for people to work, be productive, do business and investment activity. So the simple proposition that we would have as a state government is that a healthy economy makes possible greater investment in our people and in our economy, and whether that be in education, skills, training, health, essential infrastructure. They all are a critical part of that diversified economy and our economic growth. There's challenges to that, challenges you would have addressed this morning and challenges that we will all be facing, particularly as governments now go through the next couple of months preparing their budgets for the next year. The immediate ones are high inflation and the weakness in the global economy and increased volatility in financial markets and skills shortages. They're the obvious four ones that we're all addressing, and there's a lot of commentary on them. The longer term challenges, and they're ones that we need to focus on both, but the longer term ones are ultimately the ones that we need to have our greatest focus on, are an ageing population, a continually more competitive global environment, and at the table I was at, we were having a discussion earlier on about the auto industry and the need for that as an innovative, advanced industry in Australia and a global competition. So this is just but an illustration of the many ones that we have, and that economic change just places incredible stress on and premium on skills. If we talk of the ageing workforce, I often reflect that when I entered the workforce, there were 6.5 people in the workforce for every person of retiring age. When I leave the workforce, and in my business sometimes it's not at a time of your choosing, but if it is at the time of my choosing, there will be 3.5 people in the workforce for every person who is retired. So that's stark figures, 6.5 to 1 to 3.5 to 1 over one generation, just highlight for us the importance of productivity, diverse economy, and building on and developing our human capital. It's the starkest statistic in my mind for why we have to do a lot of hard work on economic reform, because we need it just to keep pace with where we are, let alone to move forward. In managing the immediate challenges, we understand the importance of maintaining a budget surplus. We need to do that, one, as a sign of fiscal responsibility and rectitude, and our own historical baggage, I guess, means it's more critical than most to do that. But secondly, we need to do it because today's budget surplus is part of tomorrow's investment in infrastructure. Now, that's a very hard message often to sell in the community if you've got an $800 million budget surplus and people come forward and say, well, spend it on, you know, these 800 fantastic projects. But it's no different from a business, it's no different from local government, it's no different from a family budget. It's just got a lot more noughts on the end, a government budget. So for us, the budget surplus is more than just AAA credit ratings. It is the investment in tomorrow's infrastructure. And we need to do that surplus again. We have to target that investment in human investments, to target service delivery and targeting infrastructure. So that's a challenge for us. So the building up the, we need to use those opportunities to build up our economy. In this context also, we're framing the upcoming state budget, which will be in about 6 weeks' time, to actually set the state up for prosperity in the longer term. And so that is a challenge, and we need to manage that well, but that is a big challenge. The longer term ones, though, that we have here are really the challenges of prosperity fall into a number of areas. We certainly need to be having a competitive regulatory environment in place so that we can actually harness the energy of the private sector and our own community to get these things happening. And in the economic and infrastructure area, clearly energy and transport are two of the huge areas that we need to be addressing. And we've been very active in reforming a lot of these, and there's more to be done. We've worked strongly in areas as health, education, water, energy. We've been advocating reforms that require national effort. And as we saw earlier this week in the announcements out of COAG, particularly the Murray-Darling announcements, we've actually seen a lot of the Victorian hard work actually coming into place. We have had the economic reform, and now we are getting national investment as a consequence of the reform. We've seen reform across a number of areas. We do need to build on the capacity of the economy, and that is policy reform. It's also our economic infrastructure. So sitting across this, the government has a role in designing an overarching regulatory environment that allows business to access the full potential of that capacity. And finally, we need to get those Commonwealth state funding structures to drive sound policy. And there's been significant progress in this recently, and I'll talk more of this later. So what are we doing then to create that competitive regulatory environment? At a state level, we've committed to a very ambitious program of a 15% reduction over 3 years and 25% over 5 years in regulatory burden. We have the methodology we have adopted from best practice from the European Union to actually measure that, and the Premier actually tasked me in my charter letter appointing me Treasurer to actually achieve these targets. So that does actually focus the mind fairly significantly, because I suspect if I don't achieve those targets, there might be a new treasurer. So we've got significant targets here to actually reduce the regulatory burden. And that is actually a very great challenge to have. We've got to feed it right through our government system, because there's no point, if the regulation doesn't serve a purpose, there's no point in having it. And if you're going to bring a new regulation, you should offset something else in its place. And what we see, as you see on the slide, we think that by achieving this target, we will actually increase the GSP of the state by $747 million simply by reducing that amount of regulatory burden. And comparative national action will actually probably increase that GSP by a further factor of 1.5. So it's a big area that we need to work on. It's a big area we are moving on, and we will see direct results for it. A competitive regulatory environment also requires a number of things. Tax competitiveness is one of them. And we, again, through bilateral work between Victoria and New South Wales, we've harmonised a number of our taxation arrangements, and that's now being rolled out to a series of other states. And at COAG, earlier this week, we agreed, through the particular working group of COAG on this area, to deal with a range of areas in harmony. OH&S, again, is one. We're on a series of key areas. Victoria and New South Wales have been attempting to harmonise a lot of the back office arrangements, and more to come. I've mentioned payroll tax harmonisation, national electronic conveyancing system. There's a range of areas in here where we can reduce the regulatory burden and create a more competitive environment. The Victorian Competition and Efficiency Commission recently presented a report to me, which I released, which, among other things, shows we can significantly reduce the burden in the food industry alone. We had one size fits all. We're trying to actually have greater regulation in areas of greater need and less in others. You don't need the same regulatory prescribements, regulatory prescription, if you are serving food in an aged care facility for a sausage sizzle in a little ass barbecue, but we periodically had very similar rules for a number of those. COAG's also accelerating the hotspot reviews which it's had in place and adding new areas. So we've determined to stretch out the competition reforms that were previously agreed. We've seen a number of those in water trading, energy markets, unfinished NCP business. So there's a lot on our agenda and a very busy year in doing it. Moving on to infrastructure, the graph in front is fairly stark on what general government sector expenditure has been in Victoria in the 6 years to 1999, the 5 years after, or the 8 years after, and the 4 years to come out of the budget estimates. And what we see is just a significant ramping up of infrastructure. And that's all about building the capacity of our economic infrastructure. We've got a very strong record. And the Premier, in a very, not widely reported, but very strong speech in Sydney a couple of weeks ago, stated that the coming decade needs to be, and I quote, a decade of action on infrastructure. And he called for joint action to lift the level of investment in infrastructure in Australia from 4.1% of GDP to 4.5% over the next 5 years. And I think there'd be probably no one in this room who would not concur with that statement. We have a need to boost our infrastructure expenditure, and because if we don't, we're not going to have those economic fundamentals in place to actually have that economy continuing to grow. So we have a challenge. We need to generate surpluses on the government side to be part of that equation. We've already, over in our forward estimates, we have broadened the amount of money that we have borrowed for these particular areas. But cash surpluses are a critical part of what we need to do to fund infrastructure growth, as well as partnerships with the private sector in expanding the areas of infrastructure we are working on. Move now to, I guess, COAG and the federal-state relationship. Traditionally, governments will go to a federal meeting and plead the case of their own government. It's often very parochial. It is my state is best, and that's what's said. It's repeated many times, and we don't really move much further than that. What we need to understand, though, is actually that many of these state infrastructure problems are actually national problems. I mean, Victoria is 24.8% of the population of the country. So if you have a major urban congestion issue in Victoria, it affects productivity in Victoria. And if it's a big urban congestion issue in Melbourne, it's probably affecting the productivity of 15, 16% of the workforce of the nation. So states are building blocks of a nation. And so these issues, which are, on the face of it, state issues, are actually national issues dealing with the GDP of the country as a whole. And it's not just a bid from states for cash, as I said. If we, for example, and we have been pressing the Commonwealth for greater assistance on urban congestion, that is an area that will boost the GDP and the productivity of this state in an extraordinary manner if we do that. And we're delighted that Sir Rod Eddington is reporting to us shortly on infrastructure east-west needs. saying delighted. It's good to have it on the table. I imagine we'll have a few problems in trying to fund what the expectations come out of it, but it's fantastic. That's the debate we need to have. We need to have the discussion. We need to be getting in place a debate on long-term infrastructure needs and the role of states, the private sector and the Commonwealth in dealing with them. Sir Rod Eddington also is chairing Infrastructure Australia, which is a great advancement from the Commonwealth to actually seek to have a common view on what these national infrastructure projects are. But I'll move now to the capacity of our people, which in some ways is the most important area of reform. The graph you see on the screen seeks to essentially show some policy work we've done to show where the greatest productivity boosts come from with investments. And so if you look at the increased productivity on the bottom, increased participation on the top, you see that investments in education and training have the greatest effects of all of how we can improve the capacity of our people, and there's a range of others that fall into that general discussion. Now, without spending too much time on the graph, it highlights a point that we need to target our investment in people if we're going to have the outcomes that we want. And we are very confident that we need to do this. We've been working on this with extraordinary investment, $6 billion extra in education over a period of years. We're seeking to target that. We're investing in education infrastructure, and there's been a range of government changes trying to integrate early childhood development with education and skills so that we have a logical progression to skill up our workforce. As I showed earlier, we have low unemployment, high employment growth. The demand for labour is strong. The demand for skilled labour is even stronger. So the human capital agenda is one of high importance to us, and we certainly are engaging in a very productive dialogue with the Commonwealth for them, who have the greater fiscal resources to invest in these areas, so that we can then at the state level deliver the important human capital initiatives that will assist us in the years ahead. Commonwealth state funding arrangements to support reform. We came a long way at COAG on Tuesday and Wednesday to moving down this path. And sustainable sharing of growth is an issue for us. Flexible funding. We spend a lot of time talking about health care agreements and how we can deal with these. We spend a lot of time talking about water, and they were publicised, but we also spent a lot of time on what are called the specific purpose payments, where we try to actually free up some of the money available so the states can target it more effectively. We want more output reporting, so the outcome is that educational outcomes are improved, students are more literate, numerate, however you wish to measure it, rather than the inputs that we've traditionally had. A year ago, I was Education Minister. And one of the, as an illustration of some of the crazy inputs that we had from the Commonwealth, I was required to report on the following. Of the 1,594 government schools in Victoria, I was required to report that they all had two flagpoles. I was required to report that they flew flags at periodic times. I was required to report that they had two posters up in the foyers of the schools with values down, specified. And I was required to report that whenever a school was opened that the plaques of the Commonwealth and the state were at equal level. Now, all of them had a political background some years ago when a federal minister was aggrieved that where a plaque was put or there was an important issue of pride in country. But the logic of the input was that I had to ask a deputy secretary in my department to collect the information, who then went to 8 regional directors to collect the information, who then wrote to 1,594 schools. Some soul had to go collect the data, feed it back all up the chain, and I signed a letter. Now, you know, that was an extreme example, but not an uncommon one, of some of the input controls. What we're more interested in is the outcome of education, is literacy, numeracy, skills. Measure it, hold us accountable, but let's not be overly obsessed by some of the input controls. So what we're looking at is a greater flexibility in these core service delivery areas, and we had 89 specific purpose payments. We've got them down to 5 with a transition of a range of other areas we're working for. So we're seriously working on a reform program targeted at outputs rather than inputs. Commonwealth has a greater capacity for upfront investments, and we're in a great dialogue with them on achieving more of that. I touched on the specific purpose payments and national partnership payments on the last slide, and they are significant challenges for us. But the national partnership payments give us opportunities to go back to some of the NCP reforms of a decade and a half ago, where you get rid of economic bottlenecks, you bring in reform, and there is a financial reward and an incentive for it to actually happen. The next steps with the Commonwealth are through this year we'll be negotiating further funding. We're trying to fix the unfair distribution between states. And, you know, I'm being possibly a parochial Victorian here, but I'm no different from treasurers for the last 108 years. We contribute to revenue to the Commonwealth, we get 92 cents and a dollar back of GST money for what we put in. It's better than what it was 6 years ago, and Queensland and Western Australia are finally becoming donor states. But often the Grants Commission formulas are based on, like, length of road, and a length of road from Cloncurry to Barkaldine doesn't cost you much to build, whereas a length of road from one part of Melbourne to the other does. So we're continuing to try and even these things up, but with economic reform and growth to GDP being part of the equation, we're very confident that areas like urban congestion and others will become greater on the screen, but far better on our radar and get better outcomes for us. And on the screen it says Commonwealth must fully fund its election promises. Part of that is a lot of Commonwealth election promises, using an example of computers in schools. It's a great initiative. We support it fully. Sometimes we have some challenges in a federation because most of the cost actually falls on the state. But they're things we're working through, and it's a very positive discussion that we're having. So in conclusion, it's great to be able to speak here today at CEDA to get your attention. I think we've got very strong grounds for confidence in this state. There are challenges clearly out there, but our economic future, I think, is bright, and it's one that we will certainly work through. We think the fundamentals of the Victorian economy remain absolutely sound. It's a diversified economy. We are heading in the right direction. And fundamentally, the improvement in Commonwealth-state relations is an enormous challenge for us to work on that and maintain it. And the fact that governments are all of the same political persuasion is actually helps, but it's not the key factor. The last time all the states were aligned was in 1969, and for those with memories, John Gorton was Prime Minister, and Premiers Askin, Bolte, and a very young Bjelke Petersen had him in the High Court over the Continental Shelf and other issues. We had harmonious federal-state relations, very strong relationship between Bob Hawke and Nick Greiner of different political persuasions. The politics helps, but what helps far more is that governments are prepared to actually accept you're part of a team, accept that each has a contribution to make, and try and get on with it. And so we had a very long COAG over 2 days, but we had some really good outcomes. So the will is there across all governments. The constellations are probably better aligned than they have been in a long time. But we have a very challenging reform path. We need to hold all nine governments together in going down that path. And the support of CEDA and the business community is very important for us to keep the pace of reform moving along. Thank you very much.